as a kid, when I was growing up, I often heard the words, "Trust me, this is for your good." I don't know if any of you identify with that, but usually it was when my parents were encouraging me, pushing me to do something that I didn't want to do, usually kind of a hard thing that just didn't want to do it in that moment. And as I was getting ready for this study, I started making a little list of all those things that were for my good, that I just really didn't want to do. Things like drinking milk and eating lima beans and making your bed and going all the way back to school to get the mitten that you lost, or running around the block 2 times every day so you can increase your endurance, mowing the grass and detasseling. I don't know if any of you remember things like that from when you were a kid, and your mom and dad, sometimes from a position of wisdom, because they're committed to helping you grow and mature, they knew what would be for your good, and they knew that in order to become a mature, responsible adult someday, you just gotta do the hard things. And so now as I look back, I can see my parents were right, and I'm thankful that they were committed to helping me mature, except for the lima beans. Never really saw the purpose with eating lima beans. But otherwise, you do have to go through hard times, and really, those things are good for us. And so today we are launching this new study from Genesis 37 through 50, and we're studying the life of Joseph. And we have titled this, All Things for Good. And so maybe when you look at this title slide up here, when you saw your book, maybe you weren't thinking of all those things your mom and dad made you do when you were a kid that were for your good. Maybe you saw those words and you thought, yeah, right. What are they talking about? They don't know my life. My life is definitely not all good in this moment. And I want you to know that I get that. I may not understand where exactly you are today. I may not have experienced your hard thing, but I have had my own, as we all have. We all have the experiences that God is giving us along the way that we are learning to trust are for our good. Over the next 6 weeks, we are going to explore this truth that God will bring good from all things, even the hard things that happen in our lives. These words, all things for good, come from Genesis 50:20. So we'll see this at the end of Joseph's life when he was able to look back over everything that happened to him and say, God meant it all for good. Now, each week we will also be focusing on a character trait of God. So as you go through each week, you will see that. This week in Genesis 37, we're going to be focusing on the truth that God is in control. Even in the really dark and difficult days, even when things seem out of control, God is in control. And along with this, we'll be learning some what we'll call lessons from the pit. Because Joseph is going to find himself in a literal pit today, a physical place. But I think we do all recognize that sometimes we all have what we could call a pit. We're in, just a pit of an experience. Sometimes those things happen as the result of our own choices. Maybe sin that we've done gets us in a place that's really hard and difficult. Sometimes a pit happens because of the actions of others. And sometimes, things come in our lives that are difficult. Pit experiences happen because the world is just a broken place, right? There's natural disasters like tornadoes and fires, and there's accidents, and there's physical illnesses and disease that cause us to go through either short times that are difficult and sometimes long extended seasons of life that are difficult. And so regardless of how you get in that situation, what you really want to know and what we all want to know in the midst of the pit is, where is God and what is he doing here and how am I going to make it through this? And so that's what we're going to look at today as we go through Genesis 37. We're going to focus on the fact that God is in control and then that we can respond in those times of being in the pit by seeking peace, by trusting God's plan, and ultimately by putting our hope in him. So let's turn now to Genesis 37. We're going to look at the first 4 verses, and we're going to kind of use this as our introduction as we get our our place here in Joseph's life, because we are going to drop in to 17-year-old Joseph. And so we're going to figure out from these first 4 verses just a little bit about where he came from. So let me read those for you, and then we'll kind of break it down a little bit. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan, and these are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel, and just so you know, that's Jacob, same, he had a new name given to him by God. Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all of his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. So tomorrow, when you go into day one of your homework, you'll be able to go back a little bit into the previous chapters and learn a few more things about Joseph's first 17 years. But for today, we can see, first of all, that we're introduced to his father, Jacob. And we learn that they are living at this time in the land of Canaan, which is in what is now modern-day Israel. In the book of Genesis that we are studying in here was actually written about 400 years after what we are studying. So Genesis was written for the people of Israel as they were getting ready to come back to this land where Joseph's family is living right now. And Moses wrote this for them so that they can know where they came from. Because over all these 400 years later, they kind of had forgotten a little bit about the things that happened and the way God had worked in their lives. And so that's what Genesis was written for, to tell them about their beginnings. So what we have here is really the beginning of the nation of Israel. Jacob was the third in line, so we had Jacob, his father Isaac, his grandfather Abraham, who God had been speaking to and giving a number of promises to. God had a promise to Abraham, Isaac, and then now Jacob that they would have a great nation. You know, their family would become a great nation. He had promised them that they would have a land for their own possession and that all the people of the world would be blessed through them. So, and that was really a prophecy about Christ. So God will give you a great nation of your family. He will give you this land to possess, and he will bless all the world through you someday. So these were the promises that had come down through this family line. And here we are now with Jacob, and we are turning the corner in verse 2 where it says, these are the generations of Jacob. So before this, we've been studying Abraham and then Isaac, if you were to go back into Genesis, and then now Jacob. And then in the rest of the book of Genesis, we're turning the corner into the family of Jacob. And this is literally now the beginning of the nation of Israel. And so this is how God began his work in this family that would eventually turn into an entire country. Now, we're introduced here in verse 2 as well to Joseph and his brothers who are out doing the family business. Jacob was a very wealthy man. He had vast flocks of goats and sheep, for sure, perhaps other animals as well. And although they had primarily settled in Canaan, Jacob would send his sons out to find pasture land for all of their animals. And Joseph evidently had the job of going out, checking on the sheep or the goats or checking on his brothers and then bringing a report back to his father. In verse 2, we also learn that this is a blended family. So we're introduced to the fact that he's out with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, two of his father's wives, but Jacob, in fact, had four wives, 12 sons, and at least one daughter. And if you were to study a little bit farther back and even in some of the next chapters to come, you're going to see this blended family is a little crazy. I mean, this dysfunction is sort of would be our modern day word for this. And for sure, this was a dysfunctional blended family in many ways. Joseph was the 11th of Jacob's sons. But he was the firstborn son of Jacob's favorite beloved wife, Rachel. And so this fact, along with the fact that Joseph was born when Jacob was kind of old, this made Jacob love him more than all of his other children. And so this favoritism, along with the fact that Joseph was bringing back these bad reports about how his brothers were doing out in the field, really set up a bad relationship amongst these brothers. And then to make matters even worse, between Joseph and his brothers, there's a couple of other things that kind of set him apart. First, we saw in verse 3 that Jacob gave Joseph a special coat. that kind of symbolized his status. In the ESV, it said it was a many-colored coat. And if you're familiar with maybe modern-day cartoons about Joseph or Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat or something like that, it is always described as a colorful coat. But historians tell us that this word actually doesn't indicate color so much. If we went back to that original Hebrew word, what is true about this garment is the fact that it was very unique, kind of perhaps a long garment. And in other places in the Bible, it's used to indicate the kind of thing that a royal person would wear. So what is true of this is that it was a garment for royalty, not what you wear out in the field to take care of the animals. And so for whatever reason, this coat made these brothers like just really hate Joseph. They really hated the fact that he was his father's favorite and had this special coat. And so as we get to the verse 4, the end of this little introduction here, we see that Joseph's brothers hated him and couldn't say a single kind word or peaceful word to him. So from my perspective, when I look at this messy family, if I were choosing a family to give blessing to bless the world with, it wouldn't be this family. This is not my ideal of a family. But on the other hand, there is some comfort for me in knowing that God, with infinite knowledge of all these things that would happen in the past, that are the things we're going to study in the weeks to come about this crazy dysfunctional family, God knew all that, and he chose to work in them. He chose to bless them and to bring good from their lives. And there's hope for us that God will do the same for us. In our messy, imperfect lives, he will bring good from everything that he's going to bring us through as well. So let's move now into verses 5 through 11, and we're going to look at our lesson number 1 today. And so lesson number 1 is that God is in control when you experience conflict. And our response then is to seek peace that's found in our relationship with him. So in these next few verses here, we're going to see the second thing that separates Joseph from his brothers. So not only is he dad's favorite with this special garment, this special coat, he also has dreams that really kind of set him apart from the rest of the family. And so in the first, in verse 5, we read the details of his first dream, and he told it to his brothers. And he said, okay, so we're all out in the field binding up grain, and my sheaf of grain stood up, and all of yours bow down to me. So his brothers got the message there. They understood what this meant to them, and it really didn't go over well, as you might imagine. Verse 8 says that after this, they hated him even more because of his dreams and his words. Now, as I was studying through this and came to this part, I kind of wondered, why did Joseph tell them the dream, right? I mean, like, he had to know they didn't like him and that they weren't going to like what he had dreamed. So why did he even tell this to them? And I want to caution us here, and it was something that came to my mind as I was, you know, kind of thinking on that, that God doesn't really tell us, for some reason, we don't need to know what Joseph's motives were in this situation. And as we go throughout this study, there's a number of times where you're just like, why? Like, why did this happen? And so we have to be careful that we don't assign a motive when one isn't given. So we don't know if Joseph was bragging and just really wanted to stick it to his brothers, or was he just telling them something significant from his life? In any case, what we do know is that regardless of the motives, God worked in this situation, and he was in control of what was happening. So regardless of why Joseph told his brothers this, doesn't really matter. God is in control of the situation. In verse 9, then, we see that Joseph dreamed another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and 11 stars all bowed down to him. And again, didn't go over well, even when Jacob heard this. So Father Jacob, you know, heard about this dream, and he even rebuked Joseph. He was like, you know, son, are we really all going to bow down to you? And so he kind of rebuked Joseph a little bit. But at the end of this section, in verse 11, it says that Jacob kept this saying in mind. So at this time in history, God did often reveal himself in dreams. They didn't, have a written, scroll or a written word of God in some way to refer to. God revealed himself in dreams. And so, it's possible that Jacob was wondering, did God reveal something significant to Joseph here? Or is this just my kid being a 17-year-old? But in any case, Jacob remembered and tucked these thoughts away in his mind. But regardless of what Dad thought, his brothers were extremely jealous. And that's the word that's given in verse 11 at the end of it. It says his brothers were jealous. So Jacob's family, Joseph's family, is characterized from what we've seen so far by conflict, favoritism, hatred, jealousy, not much peace at all, right? I think we all know times in our lives where we experience levels of conflict. Hopefully, none of us experience anything like what this family had, but we have conflict at various times, whether it's in our families, in maybe work relationships, in friendships sometimes, or even at church. And the question to us as we pause here is, how should we respond when we experience conflict in our relationships? In Psalm 34:14, we're told to seek peace and pursue it, right? So we need to be looking for peace in relationships and then go after it. Matthew 5, in the Beatitudes, Jesus says, "Blessed are the peacemakers." So there is a blessing for us that comes when we seek peace in our relationships. In Romans 12:18, it tells us that if possible, so far as it depends on you, seek to live peaceably with all. So what we see in these scriptures here is that our goal is to keep our hearts open to seeking peace in our relationships with others and then act accordingly. So we need to pursue peace. In Romans 12, we have a few thoughts then on how to do that. And of course, there's lots of places we could go in scripture to do that. But today we'll look at a few from Romans 12. In Romans 12:14 and 17, it says, "Bless those who persecute you." So yes, certainly when someone is persecuting you and irritating, annoying you, that's a time of conflict. And our goal then, to bless when we're being persecuted. And then also, don't return evil for evil. So naturally, when the words and the actions coming at us hurt, when someone is sinning toward us, the natural response is, you hurt me, I hurt you. Insult for insult, hurt for hurt. And that's not God's plan at all. God says, when you're hurt, you respond with a blessing. When you feel insulted, when you feel put down, that's when you're going to seek peace and return with a blessing. And quite honestly, to me, this is one of God's kingdom principles that seems way upside down, doesn't it? This is not our natural human relationships or our natural human reaction. But this is where we have to trust Jesus' words, that there is a blessing for us when we seek to be obedient to this truth, that there is a blessing for those who make peace. Romans 12:15 has another good thought for us in the midst of conflict, and that's to rejoice with those who rejoice and to weep with those who weep. So again, rather than being like Joseph's brothers who were filled with jealousy when good things were happening to Joseph, we need to rejoice with those who are experiencing a good time. Even if that person is frustrating you or really annoying to you, we want to be called to rejoice when someone else is rejoicing. And on the flip side, when someone is going through a hard time, enter into that with them. Experience their sadness and, weep when they weep. I know sometimes there's times when I think, especially if somebody, it's just kind of like rubbing me the wrong way. And when they go through a hard time, my natural reaction is, they're getting what they deserve, right? But no, our response is to enter into that sadness and experience their sorrow with them or experience their joy with them. So this kind of peace, this call to pursuing peace, does require that we pretty much do the opposite of what we naturally feel like. But what we have to recognize is that we don't do that on our own strength, do we? This happens only as we are first seeking peace within us, right? The peace that only God can give us. That peace of Christ should rule our hearts. So that's where ultimately peace starts. And this kind of peace really transcends what is happening around you. As it said in Romans 12:18, if possible, as much as it depends on you, live at peace. But there's an acknowledgement here that sometimes it's not possible to get all of our experience, all of our relationships in perfect peace. Nevertheless, you can still be at peace regardless of what is going on around you. You can be at peace in your heart and in your mind. Isaiah 26, 3 and 4 speaks to this. It says, "You, Lord, you keep her in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on you because she trusts in you. Trust in the Lord forever, for the Lord God is an everlasting rock." And so what we see here is that perfect place of peace in our minds happens when we are focused on the everlasting rock. And that means that when everything around us is in conflict, we can still focus on Him. He's the solid place. He's the stability in the midst of conflict. We can let His peace rule our hearts as we move to trusting His plan for us. And so that's going to take us right up to lesson number two. And we're going to learn there in lesson number two that God is in control when your dreams are shattered. And our response then is to trust His sovereign plan. And so in this next scene, starting in verse 12 and going all the way through verse 28, we see that Jacob once again sends Joseph out to check on the brothers. And so he says, and I'm just going to paraphrase here, he says, "Hey, aren't your brothers up in Shechem pasturing the flock? I want you to go on up there, check on them, and bring word back to me." So we can kind of, we have a map that will hopefully help us. I love maps. And I'd love to kind of know what I'm talking about historically. So you can take a look there. You see where it says Hebron, that is the land of Canaan. That's a city in Canaan. This is where they were living. So Jacob says to Joseph, "Hey, head on up to Shechem." That was about 50 miles away. What you can't really tell there is that geographically it was also up in, you know, kind of up into the mountains, sort of a rough trip. He says, "Head on up there to Shechem and find your brothers." So Joseph then is wandering around near Shechem, runs into a man and who tells him, you know, "Hey, I heard that your brothers went to Dothan." And then Dothan, as you can see is in the top there, is about another 20 miles farther on from there. In verse 17, it says that Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. I'm going on then in verse 18, it says that his brothers saw him from afar and they recognized him, and while he was walking toward them, they started to conspire against him. And so let's read in verse 19 what it says then, as they were conspiring against him. It said, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of these pits, and then we'll say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what becomes of his dreams." So you see here, the jealousy of these men has grown in their heart to the point that these dreams that he's having have become a huge issue. There is no way that they are going to bow down to their father's favorite. Not going to let it happen. And they were willing, as you can see here, to commit murder to be sure that it didn't happen. Now, evidently, the oldest brother, Reuben, had some issues with outright murder. And so in verse 22, he says, "Okay, shed no blood, but throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him." And he said this that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to their father. So, you know, Reuben's like, "Hey, there's an empty well here. Just throw him down there and then, but don't kill him." And then Reuben evidently went off to another location to do something else. We don't know what. So as the Joseph approached them then, I don't know if they saw him coming and noticed his coat or whether he was coming down over a plain. They saw him. He arrived. They stripped off his coat, threw him into an empty well, just as Reuben said. And then, kind of amazingly, they sat down to eat. So they've thrown their brother in the well, and here they're going to sat down to eat. And then they noticed from afar, on the other side, then kind of over to the east, they saw a group of Midianite traders coming towards them. And that's when then Judah throws out the next plan. He says, "Hey, what profit is it if we kill our brother and try to hide his blood? Let's not kill him, let's sell him to these Ishmaelites." And so that's exactly what they did. they sold Joseph for 20 pieces of silver. And this scene closes out then in verse 28 by saying that Joseph was taken to Egypt. So if you remember that map there, they kind of headed on down, you know, away from here's home, you know, over here at Hebron, headed on over to Egypt. And that's where we have Joseph going. So there's two sides of this story here, or this little scene that we're going to look at. First of all, let's think about the brothers, these men who really did this horrible thing to their little brother. In Acts 7, 9, in writing of the history of Israel, it says that the patriarchs, and so now think again, this is the start of a great nation, the patriarchs are these men we're talking about, the fathers of the nation of Israel. So Acts 7, 9, the patriarchs were jealous of Joseph and sold him into Egypt, but God was with him. So these men allowed the jealousy and hatred to rule their hearts, and it led them to take actions that they thought would control the situation in the way they wanted it to be. So regardless of how they felt about Joseph's dreams, at some level, they must have thought that this could really happen. We could be in a situation where we're going to serve our brothers, and there is no way we're letting that happen. We're going to be sure that we control this thing and make sure that it doesn't happen. And what they didn't realize is that even when we try to manipulate, even when we try to gain control, God is still in control. And so I think in some, as I was considering this scene, like it just seems impossible to me. I can't imagine such a thing. And yet on the other hand, I do know that I do often seek to manipulate and control situations around me. When things are unfolding in ways that just don't seem right, I want to try to make it work according to my plan. Usually, I'm pretty sure that my plans are good. I like my plans, and I want things to happen my way. And so what I can learn here is that I need to be really careful about the sinful emotions going on in my heart. And I need to evaluate what I'm allowing in my heart, because the fear and the jealousy, the hurt, or the anger in my heart can make me want to grab for control and to manipulate when situations aren't happening according to my plan. Proverbs 4:23 tells us that above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. That is kind of a sober warning, isn't it? What I let stay in my heart really causes me or brings actions out of me. So if you ever wonder, you ever do or say something and you wonder, where did that come from? Well, it came from inside of you. And so as I think about these 10 men who let this jealousy fester in their heart, it reminds me that I need to be aware of what's going on inside of my heart and turn from the sin that I find there so that I can trust God's plan rather than manipulating things according to my plan. On the other hand, then, we see Joseph in this scene. And truly, he was very much out of control in this situation. Nothing that he could do would change the fact that it looks at this point as if his life is absolutely changed and irreparably altered. But remember what we read in Acts 7, 9. God was with him. Even in the midst of this awful situation, God was in control. God was right there with him and working in all of this for his good. So as we think about Joseph, though, with what appears to be kind of a shattered dream situation, I think we can all identify with that at some level. Hopefully, again, not to the extent that Joseph was, but at some point, we all know times when what I thought would happen and what is happening are not together. Sometimes the gap between my hopes and dreams and my reality is a little small. You know, sometimes you just have a bad day or, you know, somebody lets you down a little bit. But there are other times, you know, when that gap is huge, when what I thought, what I hoped and dreamed would happen and what is happening are so far apart that I don't think anything good can ever come from this. Just like Joseph had no idea what his brothers were plotting that day when he walked toward them, you know, we don't ever really know either what life might bring, when we might take a turn or a dip in the road that's going to bring us to what I'll just call a pit of disappointment, to where our reality and our hopes are not lining up. In Psalm 105, God recounts for us the work that he did in the nation of Israel. And in verses 17 through 19 of that psalm, he speaks of Joseph. And it says there that he sent a man ahead of them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. His feet were hurt with fetters. His neck was put in a collar of iron. Until what he said came to pass, the word of the Lord tested him. So think of what we're reading there, that God used the jealousy of his brothers, God used the evil of slavery to get Joseph to Egypt, which is exactly where he wanted him to be. And that can be hard for us to imagine because this does not appear good to us. We don't like to think that perhaps God uses difficult and hard things to place us where he wants us to be. We see also that God tested him. And that word test is the kind of test that a goldsmith does to take the impurities out of the gold. So what we read here tells us that God used these hard experiences to purify Joseph, to refine him, and to prepare him for what was to come. Just like my mom and dad knew when I was a kid that I needed to go through some hard experiences in order to become mature, God knows what we need to help us get ready for what he has planned for us. So the fact that God has a purpose for the pit in our life, the fact that he is refining us, that helps us to know that, but it doesn't make it easier, right? And so the question is, what do we do when we're in the midst of that situation? How do you respond in the darkness of your pit? Whether it's just a little dip in the road, a small frustration, or whether it's a really deep, awful thing, we still have to decide how we're going to respond. And in my experience, in my own life, as well as walking through difficulty with others, what I've realized is that in that moment, we all surrender to something. Either you surrender to the lies of the enemy, or you surrender to the truth that God is in control and I can trust him with my life. You can surrender to the belief that God is withholding good from me in this moment, or you can surrender to the truth that God is working good for me in this moment. In the process of the pain, that he is refining me and that he will bring good from this moment. So as we sit here today in Bible study, I know that all of you would probably say, I want to surrender to the truth. I want to resist the impulse to believe the lies of the enemy. But in order to do that, we need to know the truth. And so we're going to take a quick look at Psalm 40, verse 3. It has some good thoughts for us as to how we respond when we're in the midst of a pit. So I'll read those first three verses of Psalm 40. It says, I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the pit of destruction out of the miry bog and set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. And so this psalm is one written by David, and he is using this very poetic language of a pit to describe a situation that he is going through. And at the bottom of this dry pit, he's imagining that muddy mess that happens. And it's like he's being sucked down by the miry bog. And so that's how he's describing his pit experience. And so we see that he did a few things in the pit, and I think we can learn from them. First, he waited patiently for the Lord. You see, God has a purpose to the pit, and he works on his timetable according to his plan, not ours. So we have to resist the desire to manipulate and wait patiently in the midst of the pit. And then secondly, though, we see that he cried out to the Lord. We sometimes want to cry out and complain to all the people around us, but here we see that we need to cry out to the Lord. He's the one that is the rock that's going to give us the solid place to stand in the midst of this. And then the third thing we see here is that David spoke the truth about the Lord. He was resisting the lies that kind of come into our head during these times, like God doesn't care, he's not here, he's not in control. And instead, he spoke the truth about his God. He said, he inclined to me. That means that in the midst of the pit, God leaned in close to be right near with me, and he heard my cry. So not he's silent, he's not aware there. He's not listening. Those are the lies. No, the truth. He's with me, and he's listening. And then we see that God responds. David said, he pulled me up out of the pit and gave me a solid place to stand and put a new song in my mouth. And so sometimes this happens when we come to the end of something, right? And you're in, you know, you've come through it. It's great. There's rejoicing. You can see what God has done. And other times, God leans in close in the midst of your pit, and he's right there with you. And sometimes that rock that he gives you is just one small place to stand in the middle of the chaos, in the middle of the miry bog. But in any case, he responds to you, ladies. When you cry to him, when you seek him, he is with you, he hears you, and he responds to you. And then what I think is that one of the most beautiful things about this, in verse 3, we see that when we respond by trusting God in the midst of our pit, others around us see that, and they come to know God better, and they come to trust God more as well. And so ultimately, through our growth of faith and through our trust in God, we're able to help others grow in their faith and their trust of God as well. So in the midst of that that dark pit that you are in, you can trust that God is in control. He has a plan and a purpose for the pain. He's refining you, and that he will bring good from all things. You can trust him in the midst of your difficult day or your difficult season. Let's move on then to our final lesson, number 3, in verses 29 through the end of the chapter. We'll see that God is in control when life just doesn't make sense. And our response then is to put our hope in him. So we've learned so far that we're going to seek peace in him in the midst of our conflict. And in the midst of that difficult pit, we're going to put our trust in him. And then we are going to find our hope in him when you just aren't sure what else is going on. As we go back now to Genesis 37, verse 29, it says that when Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes. He turned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?" So remember, Reuben's plan then was to go back, get Joseph, and take him back home to dad. But now he's like, "What in the world have you done? What are we going to do? What are we going to tell our father?" And so they did what people often do when they're confronted with their sin. They made a cover-up plan. They dipped that coat, that robe, in some goat's blood, and they sent it back to Jacob, and they said, "Hey, this is what we found. Do you recognize this?" And Joseph, or Jacob, of course, did recognize that coat, and he said, "Without doubt, Joseph has been torn to pieces. A wild animal has devoured him." And then in verse 35, it says, "He began to mourn, and all of his sons and all of his daughters rose up to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted and said, 'I will continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave.'" And then at the end of this chapter, verse 36, it tells us that those Midianite traders took Joseph to Egypt, and they sold him to a man named Potiphar, who happened to be an officer of Pharaoh and the captain of the guard. And so that's the end of this chapter. Kind of a bleak picture of this family so far, right? We have Joseph's brothers facing the aftermath of this terrible sin that they've committed. We have Jacob here grieving, mourning, and hopeless. And we have Joseph as a slave in Egypt. For all of this family, if you think of it, everything really seems out of control. But here's the thing, though. Even though it seems out of control, God is in control, and hope is not lost. Sometimes the present situations that we're going through can overwhelm the truth that God is in control, that we have hope in him. Sometimes when we are in the midst of a pit, it's so easy to be focused on the situation, the conflict, and what's going on around us that we lose sight of truth. And this is when then the lies and the fears that we don't deal with in our hearts come rushing back up to the surface. This is when we're tempted to believe that no one understands what I'm going through. Nobody cares about me. God isn't here. I can't take it anymore. Those are the lies that come back up if we don't deal with them in our hearts. And really, honestly, it doesn't matter what the pit is for you. We all have our own situations, and it really can be anything that Satan uses to just entangle you in those lies that you're tempted to believe. And keep you then from focusing on the truth that you can hope in God. You can have confidence in Him. He will act on your behalf. So I think at this point, a good question is, what is hope, right? So we want to have hope. We want to hope in God. But what is that really? And truthfully, first thing we need to know is that it's the opposite of what we usually say. So when we say things like, I hope you have a good day, we all understand that maybe you will, maybe you won't. Like, we hope it turns out good, but we're not sure. Biblical hope, on the other hand, is the confident expectation that God will bring good from all things. And really, biblical hope is the basis of this study as we talk about all things for good. It's really based in the character and commitment of God to bring good from all things, to keep His promises. We can have hope in God. We can confidently expect that He will bring good from all things based upon His character, based upon His commitment to bring to keeping His promises. But hoping in God is not really natural for us, is it? Especially in the midst of a difficult time. And that's why we have to be really careful to guard our hearts. Be diligent to be aware of what's going on inside of you. Confess that sin, turn from it, and preach the truth to ourselves. You know, speak the truth of the Word of God to yourself. This is especially true, of course, in really difficult times, but I think it's very true that we need to be aware of what's going on, even in the little daily frustrations. When someone lets you down, when you're running late, when life is just a little bit frustrating, in those moments as well, be aware of what you're thinking. Use those small frustrations to prepare you to respond in truth in the midst of the deep, dark, really hard times, because you really are training yourself as to seek truth in every moment as you do it every single day, even in the midst of the really small things. So as you surrender to truth in those small daily disappointments, you are training yourself for the deeper pit, the things that we know are going to happen inevitably in life. And in those times, really, there's a battle that goes on. I mean, it's one that only you can fight. Only you can decide, am I going to just go with it? Here's how I feel. I'm going to surrender to whatever comes to my mind in this moment, which is ultimately the lies of the enemy, the things that he wants you to believe. Or am I going to battle this? Am I going to fight? Am I going to submit to the truth that God is in control, that He does have a good plan for my life, that He is refining me in this moment, and I am going to submit to that truth, and I'm going to resist the lies of the enemy? And this is, as I said, truly a battle that only you can fight for yourself. So as we close out today, we're going to remember that those inevitable pits are going to come. A little bitty dip in the road, or maybe something deep and dark and long and hard is going to happen. But in any case, we can know that God is in control of those moments, and that He is right there with us. He is listening, He is responding, and we can respond by seeking peace, the peace that only He can give. We can respond by trusting His plan. He's in control, it's a good plan, and we can have hope in Him and have a confident expectation that He will bring good from everything we go through.